ask you to turn again to the book of Ezekiel. This evening we're setting off on a long trek. And I'm nervous about it. And I'm excited about it. I feel as if we're standing at the foot of a great mountain. And we're gazing up at the summit. That's what the book of Ezekiel is. It's a great mountain that we need to scale. It's vast, 48 chapters, and it involves some of the hardest climbing anywhere in the Bible. There are sheer rock faces where you can only cling on by your fingernails. And there are huge crevasses where there seem to be no way across. There are ledges which seem impassable. There are times when the mountain is shrouded with cloud and it's hard to see anything at all. And lots of climbers have tried to climb this mountain and have given up. And some have become disorientated and confused, and they've got lost. But those who have pressed on have reported that as they've climbed, they have glimpsed the most awesome views. And they have had thrilling moments. And there have been times when they've gasped with awe and amazement. And those who have reached the summit tell us that from the top you have a view that is simply astonishing. They've caught glimpses of the glory and majesty and the purposes of God that are almost unsurpassed anywhere in the great mountain range of the Old Testament. They've come down changed people with a bigger understanding of God and his greatness. They've come down stronger and wiser and braver and holier. No one can climb Mount Ezekiel without being changed by it. Well, this evening, we're only aiming to get to base camp. If we can just put one foot on the mountain, then we'll have made a start. So, where do we start? Well, we start with some history. We're reading the prophecies of a man called Ezekiel. So we need to find out something about the time in which he lived and prophesied. Ezekiel very carefully dates all the sections of his book. Not many of the prophets did that, but Ezekiel did. So we can be sure when Ezekiel received his prophecies, and we can understand the background. So that's where we start today. Let's just read the first verse of the prophecy. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the exiles by the Chebar Canal, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. Ezekiel is talking about the first time that he had a vision of God. And he tells us when that was, and he tells us where it was. It was in the 30th year. But the 30th year of what? Almost certainly he means the 30th year of his life. He's telling us that this vision came when he was 30 years old. And it was in the fifth day of the fourth month of that year. Perhaps that was his birthday. And where was he? He was among the exiles by the Chebar Canal. And where's that? Well, it was just to the east of the city of Babylon, in what is now called Iraq. How did Ezekiel come to be there? Well, we're told he was among the exiles. He had been taken with other Jewish people away from his own country, away from the land of Israel, away from Jerusalem, as a prisoner to Babylon. And it was there, by the river Chebar, just outside Babylon, it was there that the word of the Lord, the word of Yahweh, came to Ezekiel. Verse 2, on the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans, which is another name for the Babylonians, by the Chebar Canal, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. So now we can date this precisely. The Lord first laid his hand on Ezekiel 5 years into the exile of King Jehoiachin, which makes it 592 BC. Right, King Jehoiachin. This prophecy is dated with reference to him. One of the last kings to reign in Jerusalem. Grandson of the great King Josiah. A linear descendant of King David. We need to go back to Jehoiachin's grandfather, Josiah. Josiah was very young when he came to the throne. And he came to the throne at a time when the Jewish nation was sunk into idolatry, false religion, and plain, shameful wickedness. Josiah made a heroic attempt to bring the nation back from its evil ways. He abolished the heathen shrines. He destroyed the idols. He cleansed the temple. He persuaded the whole nation to return to the covenant that God had made with the nation. So during Josiah's reign, false religion was driven underground. And lots of people thought that the nation had really changed. Superficially, outwardly, it had changed. But Jeremiah, who prophesied in Josiah's day, knew different. He knew that signing up to a covenant and promising to keep it couldn't change people's hearts. Jeremiah said, their sin is still written on their hearts. It's written with a pen of iron and a nib of diamond. He knew that they hadn't really changed at all. And when Josiah died in 609 BC, the nation almost immediately collapsed back into its old ways. Josiah's son Jehoahaz became king. And he turned out to be a thoroughly wicked man. He didn't reign long, he just reigned 3 months. Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, came to Jerusalem with his army, put Jehoahaz in chains, took him off as prisoner to Egypt, and installed his brother Eliakim as king in his place. Pharaoh changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim was no better than his brother, but he did reign a little longer, from 609 to 598 BC. And when Jehoiakim died, his son Jehoiachin became king. And immediately he had to handle a huge crisis. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, was now the most powerful ruler in the whole Middle East. And he was expanding his empire in all directions. Jehoiachin's father, Jehoiakim, had submitted to him 6 years earlier. And then rebelled against him 3 years after that. Nebuchadnezzar had been preparing to deal with that rebellion. Now Nebuchadnezzar's army was ready to besiege Jerusalem. Jehoiakim had died. And it was his son Jehoiachin who had to cope with that crisis. Well, he decided it was best to surrender. And he did. This is how the writer of Kings describes the event. Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, gave himself up to the king of Babylon. Himself and his mother and his servants and his officials and his palace officials. The king of Babylon took him prisoner in the 8th year of his reign, and carried off all the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house, and the treasures, and he cut in pieces all the vessels of gold in the temple of the Lord, which Solomon, king of Israel, had made, as the Lord had foretold. He carried away all Jerusalem, and all the officials, and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen, and the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. And he carried away Jehoiachin to Babylon. The king's mother, the king's wives, his officials, and the chief men of the land he took into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon all the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen, and the metal workers, 1,000 of them, all strong and fit for war. Nebuchadnezzar, at this point, didn't destroy the city of Jerusalem. He left the city intact. He installed Jehoiachin's uncle, Mattaniah, as king. But Nebuchadnezzar stripped the city. Stripped it of all its treasures. Stripped it of all its key people. All the chief men of the land. All the military leaders. All the craftsmen. All the metal workers. Anyone who was anyone. And he stripped it of its rightful king, Jehoiachin. Carted him off into exile. And among the people who were carried off to exile with King Jehoiachin was a young man from a priestly family. A young man called Ezekiel. And that was in the year 597 BC. Now, let's just remind ourselves again. If you've done the arithmetic as we've gone along, you'll have realized that that was just 12 years after the death of the great King Josiah, the man who had held back all the forces of evil in Israel. And you can see what terrifying, shocking changes had come about in those 12 years. Just in a space of 12 years, the nation had collapsed into apostasy and wickedness. Three kings had been crowned and then swept away. Twice the city of Jerusalem had been threatened with foreign armies. The temple, the holy place which the Lord had blessed, the place where he dwelt among his people, the temple which Solomon built and which Josiah had restored, that temple had been desecrated. Foreign troops had marched into the temple. They'd ransacked the holy places, the places where only the priest and the high priest were supposed to go. They'd carved up the holy vessels which Solomon had made hundreds of years earlier. Golden vessels had just been sawn into bits. The rightful king had been dragged off with most of the royal family as prisoners. Jerusalem had been left a shattered, impoverished community struggling to survive. The economy had been ruined because all the craftsmen had gone. Ezekiel will have been 13 years old when King Josiah died, the great king, the godly king. He'll have been 25 years old when he was carried off with King Jehoiachin. And in those 12 years, Ezekiel watched his world disintegrate more quickly than anybody could ever have imagined. And finally, he'd seen his world collapse. Isn't it amazing how quickly things can change? Go back 25 years, and Josiah was just launching his great reformation. And it seemed to promise so much. A new golden age. New hope, new joy for God's people. New triumphs, the presence of God among his people again. For godly people. That was a time of heady excitement. They were sure that a glory age was dawning again. But in the 12 years since Josiah died, everything that Josiah had worked to build had collapsed. Just 12 years for a society to disintegrate, for wickedness to triumph, for the destruction of everything that godly people loved and valued. It's just shocking when things change that quickly. You don't have time to adjust, to come to terms with the changes. Back in 1970, a guy called Alvin Toffler wrote a book called Future Shock, which was about the pace at which the world was changing and about the sense of crisis that people feel when things change faster than they can handle. Some of us have felt that sense of future shock in the past 10 years or so, haven't we? I find it hard to believe just how quickly our world is changing. Globalization, technology, the rate of change is extraordinary. But above all, here in the UK, the moral change, the spiritual change. We feel we just don't recognise the world we're living in. The way that the fundamental frameworks of society, they haven't just changed, they've been turned upside down in our lifetimes. The things that society a generation ago condemned are now the things that are praised and the things that are commended. And the things that were praised and supported by the whole establishment are now the things that are treated as criminal. It's bewildering. And the change in spiritual conditions. Go back to the 1960s in this country and the 1970s. An evangelist like Billy Graham comes over from the States. And hundreds of thousands of people flock to hear him preach. Football grounds are the only venues big enough to hold the crowds who want to listen to him. The BBC broadcast his messages at full length. Today there isn't an evangelical preacher in the UK or maybe in the world who would draw a crowd of 10,000 here in Britain. There certainly isn't one that the BBC would take seriously. Go back 30 years. Go back to the time when this church was just beginning. Unless I'm viewing the past with completely rosy-tinted glasses, what I remember is that Christians and churches were viewed by society as something positive. The leaders of society wanted Christians working in the schools and the prisons and the hospitals and the armed forces. They wanted the Gideons to go into every school in the country. Now Christians are being driven out from all those places. People are being pushed out of jobs in all those spheres of society because they won't, let's say, declare that gay marriage is right and normal. All the things that we thought were fixed and stable are shifting, and they're shifting at such a pace. And many of us who are believers are left confused and shocked and bewildered and traumatized when you find that the country that you grew up in just isn't there any longer, that it's been transformed beyond recognition. Then you become disorientated. When Ezekiel was dragged off into exile, it must have been an utterly traumatic experience for him. Those 12 years since Josiah had died had been 12 years of whirlwind change. And they've ended like this. They've ended with the Babylonian armies marching into Jerusalem and ransacking the temple and deposing the king and enslaving all the leading people in the nation. And they've ended with Ezekiel himself being pulled out of his own world and dumped down in an alien world. Emotionally, psychologically, the experience must have been shattering. Let me list three things that will have made this experience so traumatic for Ezekiel. Number one, Ezekiel has watched the desecration of the temple. When the Babylonians marched into Jerusalem, it must have been traumatic for anyone who lived there. But how much more so for a man like Ezekiel, because he was a godly young man. He was a man who loved the things of God. And Ezekiel had to watch the Babylonians marching into God's temple, smashing things as they went. He had to watch as they drove out the wagons loaded with the treasures that had been collected over the centuries. He had to watch as they sawed up the golden vessels which were kept in the holy place for the Lord's worship. Yeah, different kings at different times had allowed wicked things to happen in the temple, but it was still the Lord's house. It was still the one place on earth where God dwelt. Remember what happened when Solomon finished building the temple? And when he dedicated it, do you remember? A cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. That's what the temple meant for young Ezekiel. If the Lord was going to reveal his glory, it would be there in the temple. When Josiah brought in his great reformation, when he cleansed the temple, that was the dream that godly people had, that the glory of the Lord would be seen again in the temple. That God would return there in all his majesty, in all his beauty. And where has that dream ended? It's ended with heathen people desecrating and ransacking the temple. Ezekiel has seen God's dwelling place on earth ruined before his eyes. Point number two. Ezekiel's had his own vocation destroyed. Remember, Ezekiel was from a priestly family. All his upbringing, all his training as a child and then as a young man was intended to prepare him for his 30th birthday. Because that was the day when he would enter the priesthood. That was the day when he would be allowed to walk into the holy place, into the part of the temple where only priests could go. That was the day when he would start to minister before the Lord. And who knows, maybe while he's there in the temple, while he's praying, while he's offering incense, maybe the glory of the Lord would descend. Maybe he'd glimpse the reality of God. What a sense of privilege. What a sense of responsibility for a young man like Ezekiel growing up, believing that one day he will serve as God's priest in God's house. That gives him a sense of purpose in life. It gives him a sense of identity. Did he begin to understand just what a shattering shock it must have been for Ezekiel when at the age of 25 he sees Babylonian troops marching through the gates of the holy city Jerusalem, marching into the temple, and then when he finds himself seized by those soldiers, his name's on the list of people to be deported. And he's herded off with others on the long march, which will take him all the way from Jerusalem to Babylon. And it's there he's going to spend the rest of his days. We call it Babylon, three syllables, in English. The Hebrew word is just Babel, Babel. God's people, godly Jewish people, shuddered when they heard that name. Remember how Babel began? The great city that people built in the years following the flood in order to defy God, to prove that they didn't need God. You all remember the great tower they built to show that they could ascend into heaven and turn themselves into gods. Babel was the original city of evil, of rebellion against God. Babel was the fountain from which everything unclean and unholy flowed. And that's what it still was. The great tower still overshadowed the city. And it was a city dominated by a monstrous king, a king who thought of himself as a god. So Ezekiel is uprooted from Jerusalem, the holy city which God chose as his dwelling, and he's transplanted into Babylon, the cursed city, the city where all uncleanness dwelt. His calling, his vocation had been to serve the Lord in his holy temple. And now he's going to be a slave of the Babylonians in the shadow of the Tower of Babel. How much can change in 12 years? He is the young Ezekiel, growing up in Jerusalem, expecting to spend his life living in the holy land, ministering in the holy city, serving in the holy temple. And here's Ezekiel now, and he's living in Babylon. He's an exile, he's a slave, he's in the middle of an utterly corrupt, pagan, brutal society. He's far off from that desecrated temple. His vocation has been destroyed. And then thirdly, point number three, Ezekiel has been put down in a terrifying, in fact, an overwhelming situation. Everything about Babylon must have been overwhelming for young Ezekiel. The whole city was an astonishing testimony to human power, human ruthlessness, human greatness. It was built on the great river Euphrates, one of the two great rivers of Mesopotamia. But between the Euphrates and the other river, the Tigris, the Babylonians had dug out a vast network of canals to irrigate the desert, so that the whole area had become fertile and fruitful. The whole area now is just barren, sandy desert. But the Babylonians had managed to turn the desert into a vast garden. One of those canals was the Chebar Canal, the one we read about here in verse 1. When Ezekiel stood with the rest of the exiles and looked at the Chebar Canal, he was looking at one of the greatest engineering projects of all time. And what about the city itself? Well, it was vast. It was vast beyond anything Ezekiel could ever have imagined. The ancient Greek historians say that no other city approaches it in its size and magnificence. The outward defences of Babylon were 10 miles in circumference. They were 50 feet high. They were nearly 55 feet deep. If you include the people living outside the walls of the city, you're talking about an area 60 miles in circumference. The palace of Nebuchadnezzar, it was the greatest, it was the most ornate royal residence in the world, and the great temple of Marduk, chief god of Babylon. That was just as impressive. At his heart stood a solid gold statue of the god, solid gold, 18 feet high. Any mathematician want to tell me offhand the value of that by today's standards? There were 55 other temples of Marduk in the city. There were 43 temples to other gods and goddesses. And they were all on this extraordinary, lavish, vast scale. You've seen, haven't you? If you've not actually been there, you've at least seen pictures of the vast sculptures that were brought from Babylon to be housed in the British Museum. Huge winged lions, some of them with human heads. That was the symbol of Babylon and of the rulers of Babylon. Babylon is the great lion. Savage, cruel, powerful, vast. When they placed those lions at the gates of the city, they were saying, "That's what we are." But these lions have wings. The lion can move at will to destroy other nations, and it's directed by a vast intelligence. It's the empire of man. But it's man equipped with all the strength and all the capacities of the mightiest beasts of nature. Ezekiel must have felt that big in the gigantic world of Babylon, the world of giant rulers, giant temples, giant pyramids, giant defences, giant achievements. Everything about Babylon was gigantic. The mathematicians, the scientists of Babylon, they were capable of gigantic feats. They could predict eclipses thousands of years ahead. And it seemed that the gigantic power of Babylon had crushed little Israel, and had crushed Jerusalem, and had crushed the temple, and had crushed Ezekiel himself. Do you ever feel like that? In this extraordinary world in which we live, do you ever feel that the forces that are at work in our society to oppose God and God's people, the forces that threaten you and threaten your family, your children, the forces that threaten the church, are so vast that they seem unchallengeable? The monolith of government, and the legal system, and the educational system, and the media. Oh, they're gigantic. Do you ever feel that the church is bound to be crushed out of existence? That our children are bound to be lost to the world? That materialism and secularism and humanism are bound to strangle our witness and bound to strangle our own spiritual life? If you've ever felt like that, you can understand how Ezekiel must have felt there in Babylon. He's lived through this time of colossal defeat and disappointment. And as he gazes around him at the might and majesty of Nebuchadnezzar's empire, Maybe he can't imagine anything ever changing. There you've got three reasons for Ezekiel to feel defeated and desperate. One, the temple has been desecrated. It seems that the Lord no longer has a dwelling place on earth where he can reveal his glory. Two, Ezekiel himself has lost his vocation. The work that he thought he would do for God has been taken from him. And three, he's been forced to live in a world dominated by a vast, impregnable empire of evil powers opposed to God and to God's people. And it had all happened so quickly. Ezekiel's world had collapsed, and it had all collapsed within 12 years. Small wonder if Ezekiel is bewildered and disorientated and frightened. What do believers need when they are bewildered and disorientated and frightened and despairing? What do they need? What do they need when it seems that God's cause has been defeated and that they've lost their vocation, their identity, their security? What do they need when they feel intimidated by the powers that are marshalled against us? What do they need when they feel hopeless? Answer: they need a new vision of God. They need to glimpse again the greatness, the glory, the majesty, the sovereignty of God. They need to know that God is great and that he's there for them. That's what Ezekiel needed. And that is what Ezekiel was given. Verse 1. As I was among the exiles by the Chebar Canal, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. When God called Ezekiel to be his prophet, the first thing that God showed him was himself. Ezekiel was allowed to see the glory of God. He was allowed to hear the voice of God. He was allowed to feel the hand of God resting upon him. And that's what he tells us about in the first three chapters of his book. How he saw God and how he was left stunned, overwhelmed by God himself. Ezekiel had been in exile in Babylon for 5 years when this vision of God came to him. He was in his 30th year, the year when he would have stepped into the priesthood if he had been in Jerusalem. Earlier in this meeting, we read through Ezekiel's description of what he saw. And next time we'll try to look, God willing, at some of the details. But tonight I don't want you to get bogged down in the details. I just want you to catch the overwhelming, awesome glory of what Ezekiel saw. The first thing he was aware of was a great storm cloud sweeping in from the north, with brightness all around it. And at the heart of the cloud, fire. Fire blazing. Fire breaking through the darkness of the cloud. And then Ezekiel realized that within the cloud were great creatures. Four great creatures reaching out from the midst of it. Creatures that had four faces. Each had the face of a lion, and the face of an ox, and the face of an eagle, but supremely, each had the face of a man. And they were alive. They weren't like the great statues of Babylon, carved out of lifeless stones, incapable of moving, of doing anything. These vast creatures were alive, and they darted to and fro, we're told, like flashes of lightning. And then Ezekiel realized that this cloud and these creatures within it formed a great chariot. Besides each of the creatures was a wheel that could turn in any direction. And over the heads of the creatures was a vast expanse, like the dome of the sky. And it shone like awe-inspiring crystal, spread above the heads of these creatures. And then at last, Ezekiel lifted up his eyes above the cloud, above the creatures, above the chariot, above the expanse, and he saw the throne. Above the expanse stood the throne, shining like a sapphire. And there on the throne sat a likeness with a human appearance. Ezekiel can't describe the figure on the throne. But as Ezekiel gazes at him, he realizes that the one that's sitting on the throne has the appearance of a man. But from his waist upwards, Ezekiel says, I saw as it were gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire. And from his waist downwards I saw as it were the appearance of fire, and there was brightness about him like the brightness of the rainbow. And he says, such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Ezekiel talks only about the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. He knows that this isn't the full revelation of God's glory. No man can see the full glory of the Lord and live. This is only a vision. This is a hint. This is a glimpse of the Lord's glory. But it's enough to overwhelm Ezekiel. He says, when I saw it, I fell on my face. What did Ezekiel learn on that day? He learned that God is not limited to any place. Yes, there was that temple in Jerusalem where once God showed his glory. Well, the temple had been ruined. The temple had been desecrated. But does that mean that God can't now reveal his glory? No, God can come in all his glory to Babylon. He can come and reveal his glory there. He is the omnipresent God whose glory can shine anywhere, in the darkest place. Ezekiel learned that God's power infinitely surpasses all the power that men boast and claim and show off. What are these awesome creatures that Ezekiel sees in his vision? Four strange creatures. Well, they represent all the forces of nature. And they're all at God's command. He rides on them in the way that a man rides on his chariot. The rulers of Babylon can set up their stone statues, but they can't ride them. But Yahweh the Lord controls all creation. And he can use it all to fulfill his purposes. Ezekiel learned that God is the God of heaven and earth. Nebuchadnezzar might be the most powerful ruler on earth, but the Lord sits above the expanse of heaven. He sits above the firmament. He can sweep into this world any time he chooses, mounted on his chariot. But he's not limited to this world. He reigns in heaven. He's the creator. Ezekiel learned that God is king. He sits on a throne. He sits there unchallenged. He sits there unrivaled. The people of Babylon believe in many gods and goddesses. There's only one God in this vision. And he's supreme. He has no rivals. Ezekiel didn't learn these things by reading a book of theology. He saw them. He felt them. He knew them with every fiber of his being. A glimpse of those things threw him on his face to the ground. Dazzled, overwhelmed. None of us are going to see visions of God the way Ezekiel did. The time for that has gone. But God can still open the eyes of our hearts to see him, to know him, to know with utter certainty, to know with overwhelming vividness that he is God. And when that happens, everything is transformed. You see everything in the world differently. And there's one more thing that Ezekiel learned. He learned that God cares. He learned that God understands. He learned that God sympathizes. Ezekiel couldn't describe the figure that sat on the throne. But he says, the one thing I was sure of was that he had the appearance of a man. The God whom Ezekiel saw is the God who created man in his own image, in his own likeness. He created man to be like himself, which means that God himself is like man. If all Ezekiel had seen there on the throne had been burning flame or blinding light, he'd have been left saying, oh, this God is utterly unapproachable. This God is utterly unlike me. This God is infinitely beyond me. We have nothing in common. But Ezekiel doesn't say that. He's seen the burning flame. He's seen the blinding light. But at the heart of it, he sees a God who is like man. A God who has created human beings to be like himself. A God who can enter into relationships with them. Who can speak to them, who can share his thoughts with them, who can feel for them. What are the first words that God speaks to Ezekiel? Chapter 2, verse 1. Son of man. God doesn't address Ezekiel as, you worm. You dog. He says, you're a man. You're a son of Adam. You're one of the people whom I have made in my likeness to have fellowship with me. This glorious, blazing God who sits on the throne of heaven. Ezekiel, this trembling man made out of the dust of the ground, have something in common. And they can communicate. And they can know one another. Because God has the form of a man. And Ezekiel is a son of man. Ezekiel says that when he saw God, he saw a likeness with a human appearance. He saw that God was like man. But he couldn't say that God was man. The day was still to come when God would become a man. When the God that Ezekiel saw would not just take the appearance of a man, but would take real human flesh and become a man, would become one of us. When Jesus, the God-man, would be conceived in the womb of the Virgin Mary, Jesus is God made man forever, able to sympathize with us, able to understand our fears and our vulnerability and our hurts and our weaknesses and our depressions and our swings of mood and our shame. Ezekiel says, I saw God in all his glory, and he was like a man. We say we see God in all his glory, and he is a man. He has become man. He has stooped down to take our flesh, our nature, to become one of us. We need to glimpse God's glory again. The majestic one, present in all places, infinitely powerful, using all creation for his own glory, reigning on earth and in heaven, and one with us. A man who knows us, a man who understands us, a man who died for us, a man who lives for us, a man who loves us forever. We need to see the glory of God in the only place where we can see the glory of God, in the face of Jesus Christ.